an Ironic Media production. Visit us at ironicmedia.com.
There's four main components of an estate plan. There's a will, trust, power of attorney for finances, and power of attorney for health and living will. So those are usually very intensive documents. The will and trust are very financial and legal in nature, about your beneficiaries, all those kind of details. More goes into place after you die. So you put that into place beforehand. The POA for finances, the power of attorney for finances, and the power of attorney for health, or we'll also talk about the living will, are things that go into place when you're still living. And what we're going to focus on today, because even though estate planners do a great job, and I work with many of them on the power of attorney for health, some of them are also just kind of like doctors. Lawyers are not always the best people to talk to about what you want or don't want in terms of quality of life, and don't spend the time, and you're kind of not given the opportunity to go more in depth about it.
Dementia Discussions. Here to help and empower our heroic caregivers with knowledge and experience. Dementia Discussions with the caregivers themselves and memory loss professionals. Here to help with 30 years as a geriatric social worker, is your Dementia Discussions host, Barbara Hammond.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Discussions. I am Barbara Hammond. Today on the show, my guest is Stephanie Elkins. Stephanie is an aging life care manager and end-of-life doula. She has many years of experience in the nonprofit world and as a professional in geriatrics. She started her own company called Be Present Care, which guides and supports families in end-of-life conversations, end-of-life planning, and connecting with programs in the community. She is a compassionate, dedicated, and resourceful connector for her clients, very committed. With that said, Stephanie, welcome. It's great to see you this morning.
It's great to be here with you too, Barbara.
We're going to be talking about end of life, which is kind of an uncomfortable conversation, a tough conversation to have for many of us. But I guess before we get started, tell me about your personal history. End of life doula is interesting. How did you get into all of this?
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's a pleasure to be here with you and be with your guests and your audience as well. And it's really about education and support on this journey that you're all on for yourselves and with your loved ones. And so that's kind of how it got started for me. I had amazing opportunity. My background's always been a nonprofit, working with older adults. I got started because my mom was an activity specialist in an assisted living facility, and I started calling bingo. And from there, I was always comfortable working with older adults and really wanting to be of service. So that's key on my journey. And then I had an amazing opportunity to work for the Lisa Gibbons Memory Foundation, where I ran and oversaw a program called Lisa's Care Connection, which is a free resource and support center for family caregivers dealing with Alzheimer's and other dementias. And so that's when I met you, because we worked closely together as your medical social worker, and I created this space for people to feel supported and get educated, empowered, and energized. And so I really got to see the breadth and the roles of the family caregiver and everything that was really needed to support and guide. And so I was happy to be part of that space. One of the areas from that I realized is around education, especially around end of life. And that's where I kind of felt that around hospice and palliative care, there needed to be more conversation and opportunities for that, even though, because you were talking about, there's a lot of fear, and I wanted to take away the stigma and anxiety. I ended up working for Compassion and Choices, which is another national nonprofit focusing on improving care and expanding choice at end of life. And then I had another amazing opportunity to be part of a political team, even though I'm not very political, I'm more the education side of things, to pass the California End of Life Option Act. And so that's when I got more exposure and experience around education on all end-of-life options, including medical aid in dying, and then having access to that. And that comes back to education. And then I had the opportunity, it was time for me to really, because I'm a hybrid in terms of elder care manager, geriatric care management, and end-of-life doula, to start my own practice, Be Present Care, doula is something where maybe you may be familiar with or heard about around birthing and really being that support for the person or the client, non-medical support, providing emotional, spiritual, and practical support while giving birth. And that's so important around death because we don't talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so my role, especially around what we're going to talk about today around advanced care planning, is a real precursor to getting exposed and start exploring for ourselves and advocating on ways of knowing what you want or don't want. And we'll be asking some questions of you, which you probably already know of what's a good or bad death experience from what you've already seen in your life or the life of others. So that's kind of where I am right now. And it's so great to be here with you to kind of be an educator and checking in with you to see what you are already doing, what you might have to update, what you want to reflect on, and maybe validate what you're already doing.
That's great. That's perfect.
All right.
Yes.
I know that was very wordy, but I'm here to kind of just check in with all of you around making sure you have certain conversations and directives in place for your end of
life. Okay. So let's start with some basics. Talk about comprehensive estate planning.
Yeah. So some of you have gone to educational programs or there are what's called a comprehensive estate plan. And you usually might have been talking about this with a lawyer, kind of estate planning. And so it's very kind of macro. And there's four main components of an estate plan. There's the will, trust, power of attorney for finances, and power of attorney for health and living will. So those are usually very intensive documents. The will and trust are very financial and legal in nature, about your beneficiaries, all those kind of details. More goes into place after you die. So you put that into place beforehand. The POA for finances, the power of attorney for finances, and the power of attorney for health, or we'll also talk about the living will, are things that go into place when you're still living. And what we're going to focus on today, because even though estate planners do a great job, and I work with many of them on the power of attorney for health, some of them are also just kind of like doctors. Lawyers are not always the best people to talk to about what you want or don't want in terms of quality of life and don't spend the time and you're kind of not given the opportunity to go more in depth about it. I know support groups, I know Barbara runs some support groups, manages, and those kind of come up in there, but there's nobody really responsible to ensuring these really detailed conversations. So that's why we're having it today. So we can go dive a little bit deeper into the power of attorney for health or living will, which we call advanced care planning.
Good. Yeah, because it is important to talk about what you'd like at the end of life and to start those conversations early.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. It's basically what we have in place now. I call it advanced care planning, but it's really about conversations and directives, like actual physical documents that are not hidden away, that are not in the safe, that like, okay, I got it. It's locked up in a safe place, but these are like active, ongoing. It's a process of conversation and vital directives to express your healthcare goals and wishes when you're not able to speak for yourself, when you don't have capacity. And I know many of you might already have, or you might be in a position that might be you someday if you have dementia. So the idea is planning ahead, and this is an ongoing updates of these directives. So that's what we're really going to do. It's talking about what's your goals, values, and wishes when it comes to your own health, of what you want and you don't want, and who would you want to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself?
Yeah, very important. A question, I guess, would be, when do you start doing these documents?
Okay. There's kind of like the 5 D's. I don't know if you've heard about the 5 D's, but mm-hmm. This is kind of like to give you a format, because some people are like, oh, yes. Because when you go into the hospital or you go into a surgery, they're like, oh, do you have an advanced care directive? And you're like, oh, or do you have somebody that is your agent or your surrogate? You're like, oh, yes. Well, that could have been from 2012.
Right.
Right. And that is over a decade ago. So, right. I think that's is that less than
almost,
almost a decade?
Yeah.
I don't know my math. I'm not, you know, but you know, every decade. So these are the 5 D's of when to review your directive. Every decade, if there's a divorce, because maybe your relationship with somebody is different, and every state, it's a little different related to the divorce or all ruling, but diagnosis. if you have a chronic or terminal disease, a diagnosis, that might be a time when you want to change or reevaluate your advanced healthcare directive.
And that's usually what comes up, at least with the clients that I have or in our support groups. Usually a husband and wife have put each other as their agent, right, as their decision maker. And then someone is diagnosed with dementia. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, oh, my spouse will not be able to make decisions for me. I need to rethink this.
Well, that is key. And what I would love to see and advocate for is that when there is a diagnosis, and some institutions, some healthcare organizations and research centers are doing this, when there is a diagnosis, care planning conversations are being held at the same time.
Yeah, good point.
And so it's part of the checklist of, and I think the Alzheimer's Association does is like review it and update it. But it's really about the diagnosis. And when I say this, it's for both individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's key because caregiver health, we know, is also a public health crisis. Mm-hmm. So the idea is of you, not, I know we're always about focusing on other people. We know caregivers, right? You're dedicated, but it's really about doing them at the same time and updating. And I think this is the key with diagnosis. It's when we look further about living will and so on, it's an empowering time to reevaluate. I know it can be, there's some grief involved. I'm not denying that because this is a significant change. So I understand that. The next, so we have the decade divorce diagnosis. We also have decline.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a decline, let's say if in dementia, but or even in cancer, mm-hmm. people can live a long time and they're in remission and they're like, we're doing every treatment, we're moving forward. But there could be a certain point in talking with your doctor and your family, and you've gone through years or 8 months of treatment and you're at a certain place with the results that says, you know what, my time, instead of going in and out of the hospital to get infusions or getting treatments, I just want to be at home with the family. And so that's a different type of place of what treatments you want. So if there's a decline, this is it. Like I said, it's an active document that you can review it. And the final kind of one to do it is death. Mm-hmm. Once again, there's, if somebody else dies and they're your agent, you might want to update that so somebody can be present for you and speak on your behalf and vice versa. So it's one of those things that we don't necessarily talk about. In end of life planning of wrapping up after somebody dies can be an overwhelming time too, but advanced care planning is part of it for yourself as well.
Absolutely. And the sooner you can start these conversations, the better, clearly.
Yeah.
So
people might already have them ongoing because the idea is to share it as much as it is in the written form. And that's why I love the idea of watching movies or films or music, or somebody is in the news that talks about the kind of death they have and the experiences and what you would, and reflect on that if that's something that you would want for yourself or not. And that's kind of where I start with the advanced care directive and planning the conversations, is what good or bad death experience have you had, and what brings you to filling out the advanced care directive now?
I'm sure everyone can think about what they would like at the end of their life.
Or what they don't want.
Or what they don't, yeah, or what they don't want.
I mean, I'm sure you've had a lot in your groups that some people are concerned. My mother's mom's been in the state for a while and she's not, she can't engage. And I know this might not be what she wanted, or I know that maybe she's comfortable with that, but that's not what I would want for myself.
Right.
When you have that in your head, that I'm here for my mom and I'm going to do everything, but I know this is not how, what would be quality of life for me if I'm not able to engage or have a conversation with my loved one, or I'm not able to get out of bed on my own.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this ability to make these decisions when we can. So let's talk about them. What goes into the advanced directive?
So there's some really basic templated ones that are out. The basic components of it, I'm going to run through them really quickly, and then I'm going to go in more into detail for some of them. There's usually about five components that go into what's called an advanced directive in a living will. They're kind of bunched together. It's called different things in different states. There are different models out there. Some of you might have heard about the five wishes, or your healthcare system might have one, or your lawyer has one. They're all basically the same. And those components are of one, power of attorney for healthcare. And that is assigning an agent, or surrogate decision maker on your behalf. So that's one. Okay. So we'll get into that because that's a really important one. Two is a living will. And that is to identify what is quality of life for you. Kind of what's your, what you want or don't want, what sustaining treatments that you would want or not want at different points in your life. The third one is organ donation. That's something that also needs to be planned in advance. I know some people have their, on the driver's license, they right. have organ donation, but sometimes that's another thing we can talk more about, if planning ahead for that, if that is important for you as a person to be able to give back to science or so on, or for people that are in emergency situations.
Does that include like donating your brain for
Yes, research.
Alzheimer's?
So it all uh-huh. needs to be in there. There's a place to be like, usually that's something to plan in advance, but you really have to fill out some paperwork. So that's why there it's like, it's hefty because it's, I always say this work is both profound and pragmatic. Like that's, and it's overwhelming at least, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why having, I like to be an accountability buddy to make sure they get through this. Right. Then there's the physician designation. Hopefully many of you have a physician for your loved one or your partner or for you, that it's optional to have the doctor in there in your directive. And then the signature and witnesses to making sure it's completed and documented. So those are the five main components of an advanced care directive. And so we can now, if you'd like, just kind of go through those in a little more detail.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. So who's going to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself? I don't want to assume anything. Barbara, right? We don't.
Absolutely. You want to pick someone who you trust. And like I said, it's often your spouse, of course, that you've had mate perhaps for many years. And then that might change over time.
Yeah. And so it's very kind of mindful to think about that, to assume. I mean, there is kind of the, you know, next of kin kind of thing. It's a spouse, it's a parent, it's a child, a sibling. Mm-hmm. But it's really important, I think, some of the main features in choosing someone. And it might not always be the partner.
Right.
We assume it is, but that might be not the person that you think that in trusting that they will do what you want in terms of not prolonging life.
Right.
Some of the things you might want to consider in terms of choosing an agent or decision maker is their geography of where they're located in proximity to you. I mean, I know that was really different when COVID happened because that wasn't as relevant. But, you know, the idea of geography is somebody to be there if and when, like to be by your side. The other thing could be their comfortability with health, medical lingo and conversations. It'd be the healthcare professional in your family. Maybe that they're the ones that you might want to choose to be your proxy. That's the other word out there.
And maybe thinking about, like you were saying, someone who's going to honor your wishes without their own emotions.
Oh, emotions. Oh my goodness. That's the
run
big
high.
One, right?
Right. Exactly.
I was talking to a family and they're like, not my husband and not my oldest daughter, because they're emotional, they're sweet, they're not going to, I know it's going to be too hard for them. And I have experience enough and advocate for enough that I need somebody that can be more straightforward and work with the doctors and ask the questions and be patient and not emotional. So there's always a first agent, and then you can have a second and third. Some people have co-agents. It's not always recommended. I mean, because people are like, how do I choose between one child and another? Like, I don't want to leave them out. Some might be like, fine, I don't want this. Some might be better more with the finances. Some could be the power of attorney for finances. And the other one is the health. So you can kind of give them different, everybody, even though caregivers usually wear all roles, maybe you can switch that up.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I encourage families to do that. I encourage the son or daughter with whatever strength they have to go with that.
Yeah. So yeah. You might already have that in place. And I think some are, the more specific you are in terms of details for whoever's going to be your agents, your family, it's such a gift. Mm-hmm. And I mean, sometimes we don't always have the clarity, especially when we're in good health, we can't really give the specifics. But over time, if you start these conversations earlier, then it won't be so profound when you do have it in your sick, because this is just regular normalizing, having conversation of what's important to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does get tricky when you don't have children, you don't have a spouse, you're aging by yourself, you're trying to figure out who's going to make these decisions for you.
thank you for bringing that up. Solo agers is huge. And who do you turn to? There are what's called in California and other places called fiduciaries. Mm-hmm. And you can find fiduciaries for health and finance. And those are individuals that are willing to partner with you to do it. Now, there is some financial aspect of that, but then you know that you're not, even if you have family, you're not burdening your family for these decisions because you really have really strong beliefs on what quality of life is for you. So maybe you want to hire somebody to kind of do the power of attorney for health, to be that person for you. And also family dynamics are large.
Right.
So maybe you don't want it to be a family member. The other thing to think about is if you don't have this in place, it might be a family member that you turn to, like a solo ager, and maybe you don't have a relationship for you with your family for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so really identifying somebody and filling this out, because the default is family. Right. So I think it's two different ways of looking at that in terms of identifying somebody and filling this out. I just have a quick story of when I was working in hospice. I was called to do what's called an explanation benefit to bring somebody on a hospice. And it was a neighbor of a gentleman who was basically taking his friend to all the appointments. We were sitting there for an hour talking about his neighbor, his friend, that he knew he wasn't doing well and needed to get on hospice. His level of care was different. And he just wanted to be comfortable, and not, he was working on comfort, not curative care.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we went over to visit the neighbor, he already had died. And at that point, his friend wasn't nominated to be his advanced health. They didn't have a directive in place. So also in order to getting the body to take it to for disposition,
the mortuary,
the coroner had to find family members. And this gentleman did not have a relationship with his family. So once again, that is another reason why sooner than later to acknowledge if it is a neighbor. I mean, I know that's some of who we go to. I remember my grandmother's life, the neighbor Fran was so important to our family in terms of keeping us informed of how my grandma was doing. I mean, she wasn't her directive, but like knowing who else is around to help. Just want to acknowledge that as well.
Yes. Thank you. So, okay. So we were just talking about that power of attorney for healthcare. Next on your list was the living will. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So as we were talking about in terms of documents to acknowledge, in some states, it's two documents, and in some states, it's one. It's the advanced healthcare directive. There's the power of attorney and the living will. In California, it's one, so you don't see it as much, but we just talked about who your agent's going to be. And now we're talking about living will or prolonging or sustaining treatments. And this is more about what is quality of life for you and what measurements of treatments that you want or don't want. And sometimes it feels like in many directives, it's black and white, and where's the gray? And there is an it depends, or there could be a time based on some of this. Some of these treatments that we're talking about is CPR, respiratory treatments. Some can be non-invasive or intubation or ventilation, feeding tubes, kidney dialysis, and antibiotics. Now, for each one of these, you can decide, do you want this kind of treatment or not? Or it depends. Maybe it's for a short period of time. Maybe it's 2 weeks. Maybe it's a little longer. These are all in relationship to your doctors. So this is why you really want to have an agent to be like, okay, if we get this treatment, what's the quality of life going to be if they get it?
Right.
And that's
right.
A key component of asking, yes, it might save their life, but what does that life look like?
Mm-hmm.
And especially with different areas of dementia, when it comes to antibiotics, if they've been in a state of end of life state for a while, antibiotics can keep them living longer. But, you know, what's the quality of life there for that individual, or what they've shared with you or for yourself?
And I think feeding tube is a big one, because I think people who have struggled, have had dementia for many years, and then swallowing becomes an issue. Doctors might offer a feeding tube, and you have to really consider the quality of life that your loved one is in when you decide to put a feeding tube in. And is that a life that you want to prolong?
Yeah. And I think that's great, because sometimes when we're given options, end of life options, this is an option. But there's also an option to say no.
Right.
To be an advocate saying no, what will happen if I don't want that treatment, or my loved one doesn't want that treatment right now, mm-hmm. and then what are the options? And that's when you maybe move from curative to comfort care.
Right.
We can talk about that. In terms of deciding on treatments and wanting everything, or just say, no, what are the other options if I don't get treatments? One of the things I wanted to share at the end of life, when the feeding stops, when somebody is not taking in, that's part of the end of life process in general. The idea, especially for Alzheimer's or in general dying, food intake limits and our body is shutting down. So it just might be a normal part of that process, even though if at that point to make a real decision, right, with the feeding tubes, if you want to continue on and feeding in that quality of life, if somebody's just staying in bed and they're kind of bedridden on a feeding tube or they can't engage in a certain way. So that is a key area to decide. But just knowing, and I know we'll probably have Barbara, you're going to potentially have another episode of what does the dying process look like? And part of that is food intake and minimizing, and it has nothing to do. And I know all of us are in our caregiving roles are like nourishment is part of it, but that's also part of the normal dying process, which is another form of education that we can probably do at another time.
Absolutely.
So I wanted yes. to acknowledge that. So some of the times when you might want to consider these and when you're viewing sustaining treatments or not, is if you have a life-limiting illness and close to death. So when we were talking about before, when should you reevaluate?
Mm-hmm.
Your directives is being in a coma with little reasonable expectation for recovery, irreversible and severe brain damage, progressive illnesses such as ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or other dementias, heart disease, end-stage cancer, and COVID-19, and when trial treatments may be more applicable.
Mm-hmm.
When you're filling out the directive, it's for your state of where you are right now at this moment for what you would want. So if for those that are in a position of having dementia or are mild cognitive impairment, there's opportunities for you to reevaluate at different steps of it.
And that's really important to talk about because your wishes might change over time.
Yeah. And when it comes to, I'm going to put a side note and go, when it comes to dementia and these sustaining treatments or not, there have been other tools and addendums that have been created because when talking with caregivers, some that were cared for their parents that has Alzheimer's and now they're facing it for themselves, is identifying markers of what you would or would not want at certain points in the disease. And so there's these additional values and priority tools and directives and addendums that you can add on to the directive that can be more specific, that if you have dementia or you're concerned about getting dementia or Alzheimer's, that you can be very specific with certain markers of if you want to still live as long as possible, I want no life-saving treatments, keep me comfortable and then stop and avoid any treatments that are preventing me from dying from other diseases, or keeping me comfortable while stopping all treatments and withholding food and water so that I can die peacefully.
This is a very cool document, and I had never seen this before you told me about it. It really talks about like the different parts of dementia and what you would want. Let's see, how can I say this?
I call them markers.
Like, yeah, markers. Like I have forgotten everything about my past, but I still recognize those closest to me. It's sort of pulling out a different like stage in your dementia.
Decline.
I don't know how to say this.
Your decline.
Your decline, right. And deciding what do you want at that point.
Right. So it goes from I've forgotten everything about my past, but still recognize those closest to me, to I can no longer feed myself, to I can no longer toilet myself. I no longer recognize my loved ones, but I still smile and see happy in my own world. So there's various aspects. It can bring fear. It's really looking it in the eye, and you have to be very kind with yourself as you go through this and maybe having a partner to do it with. These documents were created in response to individuals wanting various options for themselves and saying, okay, this is not quality of life for me, but also don't qualify for medical aid in dying, which is another end of life option.
So, and we'll put this in the show notes what we're talking about is something called the Dementia Values and Priorities Tool, and can be found in the Compassion and Choices, right? That's the national name for the, it's Compassion and Choices, Stephanie?
I'm going to give you two, Compassion and Choices, Dementia Values and Priorities Tool, and there's also the Dementia Provision Advanced Directive Addendum. It's really about how, like visualizing how you want to do this. And these are different documents to include and share and speak about with your healthcare professional, with your family, with whoever you want.
Right.
Or don't want. So families don't get in each other's way, you know?
Well, with as many people as possible, with your kids, so that there are no surprises at the end. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very important. Yeah. It's a great tool that really needs to be used when you're first diagnosed, when you still have capacity to make these decisions and understand the document. And that most people don't want to talk about as the disease goes on, but if you can, it's super helpful to your loved ones.
And I know it's kind of shocking, but that's why talking about this and just not normalizing, making it okay to talk about fears or your anxiety around this and giving people the opportunity, because how often do we say, if I only knew, or if I had this, it could have been very helpful. So that's why Barbara and I were both guides for people in trying to meet people where they are. This is, you have to be ready for it. So I understand when some people are not ready for it, but kind of going, okay, what's underlining that fear of getting into more details about what is important or not important for you? Because once again, this can be a gift for others.
Absolutely. A gift for others. So I just have to say, when my mother, before my mother died, she would always say to us, so there's five, I'm the youngest of five.
Oh, okay.
She would always say to us, I don't want you kids to fight. And I have to say, that is the one thing we all remembered. And so after she died, when it came to like dispersing her things, we didn't fight. You want that? Okay, you take it. Whatever it was, we all remember that my mother said, I just don't want you kids to fight. So
that's so beautiful. I mean, how powerful was that?
Right. Very.
So powerful. And it's not about us. That was the gift, right? Because it can be such a tumultuous time. We've talked to so many caregivers that said, I will never deal with my family members again after my parent dies.
Right.
Because it's so devastating, because everybody's grief and roles are different. And so, well, I actually want to finish up the Advanced Healthcare Directive, because what we've done, I'm just going to review it again.
Yeah.
We did the power of attorney for health, who's going to be your agent or surrogate decision maker. The living will, which is what are the treatments you want or don't want at end of life. And then we also talked about the addendums related to dementia for that reason. Okay. Now, the third component of the directive is organ donation. And that's one of the things that you do also need to plan ahead for. There are some amazing institutions, universities and so on, that does different research. I know it's important for many people that have been involved in clinical trials or research. It's important to give back to, you know, their alma mater or what they've participated in. So that's something that you need to work for, plan in advance, and then put that information in the directive. The next thing is a physician designation. Once again, that is, if you have a relationship, I hope you do, with healthcare team members, that they're in your directive, but that's optional. And the last thing that's really important as part of these directives, along with the conversations, like you just heard from Barbara, her mom was like, just don't fight. Like, that doesn't normally come in a that's golden. and if you create your own directive, there's room for that. Like, what's important for you? What's important for your quality of life is that your children don't fight. Like, that is amazing. So when it comes to signature and witnessing these directives, you could either have a notary or you can have two witnesses. Your witnesses cannot be your healthcare agent. It cannot be your healthcare provider or an employee of them. It can't be an owner or operator of your assisted living facility that you're in. Only one of your witnesses can be a financial beneficiary. Okay. And they have to be 18 years old, over 18. And so those are some of the, if you are also a patient living in a skilled nursing facility, when you write your advanced healthcare directive, one of your witnesses must be a patient, a advocate, or a bondsman. Hopefully, if somebody has a directive, because you guys are all planners here, right? or you've had the opportunity with your through Alzheimer's Association or with your support group or your lawyer or your healthcare to have these conversations beforehand before you get to skilled nursing facility. So then, now that it's signed by a notary or it's witnessed by two people, where does it live? It lives on your person. It lives near you. You have copies of it. It's uploaded or scanned in your My Health Plan.
Right. It's not in the back of a file cabinet.
No, it's in that your favorite color folder on your desk. I think there's one woman I was talking to who says, my death file. But even though this is beforehand, if you can't speak, this is beforehand, or it's a certain color folder. And once again, when I ask people, it's always in process, but this is one of the ways to do it. One of the things I also wanted to share at this point is if you're on Medicare age, that there is now a code for these type of conversations, care planning conversations. This went into effect a couple of years ago. It was originally called death panel conversations, and then it was changed to advanced care planning conversations. And these are so vital. So your doctor, once you have your annual, I encourage when you have your wellness checkup, your annual wellness checkup, you say, oh, I have my directive done, or I would like for you to put this in the file and let's talk about it. Because a lot of this medical stuff in terms of the living will, you want to say, okay, doctor, this is where I'm at. Have a dialogue with your doctor at that time of some of these sustaining treatments. And it really relates to kind of age and your own health, what treatments you would want or not want to consider, or your own life and death experiences.
So that's interesting. So now it's a billable code.
Oh, yeah. You can do it. They're 15 minutes and you can have as many as possible. So I would suggest you integrate that into your conversation. And this is the best thing that you can do for yourself is be an advocate for yourself and be empowered. The doctors are there for you to talk about. So take advantage of it. And so that's kind of another kind of a win for you as, okay, it to completion, right? So we're talking about completed versus how is it completed is knowing that you've talked to your healthcare team, you've reflected on how to have the conversations with family members, because that can be really hard. Some people don't want to hear it, like, you're never going to die. Like, that's not true. But people are so fearful. They're like, oh, that's a long way away. But it's about you having the opportunity to do it, to share it.
Yeah, all really good points. Okay, so there is another document, and here in California, it's called the PULSED, Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
Yes.
In other states, it's called...
It's called MOST or MOLST. So they're all right. Called different things. The reason why it's changed in other states and it should be here is because now, along with physicians that can fill it out, nurse practitioners can fill it out. And this is a form, you're right, this is another directive. It doesn't take the place of an advanced directive, everything we just reviewed, right? Everybody 18 years and older should have one of those. A pulse is really more significant. And they say within the last year of your life, if the doctor feels that your prognosis is kind of hard, but that's when that really should be filled out. It's that hot pink form here in California. Mm-hmm. And that's also something that should be put on the fridge or on your person to have. And that's more specific about what life-sustaining treatments you want or don't want.
Yeah, very important form. And if you were to call 911, they'll look at it, they'll adhere to it. So it's a physician's order, and it's taken seriously by paramedics and everyone. And it goes with you when you're transported. You're taken by 911 into the hospital. Usually your pulse goes with you. So it can be something that can be it can be laminated or in a sleeve, like you said, on the fridge.
And yeah, this is very relevant in terms of really wanting that person's or your wishes honored. Once again, there's always discussions with the doctors, but they might not even know you if you're rushing in of what you want or don't want, or maybe you don't even want to go to the hospital. So that is one of the things of pulse is really relevant, utilized, acknowledged document here in California.
All right. And it might start out on there's three options on the pulsed, right? Three boxes, full treatment, selective treatments, or
No treatments.
No treatments. And they say it in a really gentle way, like allow natural death.
Yes, allow natural death. And that's when you're talking about the feeding and food intake, and that's all part of that. And that's one of the things that we talk with healthcare professionals. Doctors don't necessarily, because they always are for hope and curative, and you have a specialist and they're like all options. But sometimes it's like, well, what's the best option for where I'm in my life right now? And that's when sometimes we talk about palliative care and hospice, because that is part of the medical team, the medical treatment team. It just meets you at different locations. Can I go into that a little bit?
Absolutely. Please do. Yes.
So palliative care is an umbrella term, and palliative care comes in different locations. Sometimes it's inpatient in the hospital, and sometimes it's outpatient. We're now seeing it come more an outpatient and being offered as well, because with palliative care, you get an integrative team. You do not have to be terminally ill to have palliative care consults, or you can have a chronic condition, because palliative care is about pain and medication management, as well as having those important conversations like we've been talking about right now of what you want and don't want. And so those palliative care, when you hear palliative care, it means that those individuals, those professionals, be it a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, a spiritual leader, that they're more equipped to have the conversations and meeting you where you're at, and in terms of what you want or don't want and your fears. So when there is a shift in care, when families are concerned and in their hospital, not sure what to do with mom or dad, I would say, can we have a palliative care consult? And that's automatically an aha break of, okay, we really want to evaluate what's best for this individual. Hospice is something that, so palliative care is an umbrella. And like I said, you can have a chronic illness to get palliative care. Hospice is care. It's still medical care that meets you wherever you are. Now, this is really the shift in terms of curative care to comfort care. And it doesn't mean all treatments are stopped, but it's relevant to whatever that disease state might be. So it's not all or nothing. It's not giving up. It's about providing care, the level of care you want right now. And for some, it's not continued treatment. It's not continue going in and out of the hospital. It's about having the comfort at home and having care come to me. And that care can look like you also get an integrative team of a medical doctor, a nurse, a home health aide. I forgot that before, that maybe can do WASH, a social worker, a chaplain, and also a volunteer. These treatments come to you. So instead of, and it goes really well with the post, is if you or your loved one don't want to be rushed to the hospital, you call the hospice team and they provide the medical care you need at home. You also get medical equipment like oxygen or a bed or other things that might be covered. Hospice is a Medicare benefit. It doesn't include caregiving support like 24-hour care. Hospice comes in, provides treatments, and then leaves. So the caregiver is still the family member or the neighbor still has most of that responsibility, unless you have a paid caregiver as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Hospice is a great service. And it's like you said, it's more of a status than a place. So yeah. Now these Especially days, you don't go to a hospice anymore. Hospice comes to you.
Yeah. And it depends on where you're living, because there are some hospice homes, like people think, oh, there's places to go die in other locations and other places in the country. They do have those homes. They're very costly to run. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why they're kind of not there. Hospices can be for profit or nonprofit. It is also a physician prescription or order. So you do need to talk, but I always also suggest asking sooner than later of just education about hospice, right? Because I think it's a value added benefit that people don't know about. And it's not about days. The benefit can be because it's you review to see if you still qualify. So it's not about days being on it. It could be weeks and months. And a lot of people tend to get better when they're on hospice because they're getting more deliberate care in their home. So that's something else to consider. Yeah.
And that's okay if you get better on hospice, then you would go off of hospice because, as you say, there are these certification periods. Right. So after several months, you're either certified to continue or you come off of hospice, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of eligibility, I just want to kind of give kind of a general. Yeah. This is not as clinical, but just general. Mm-hmm. It really relates to people's terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less. And sometimes prognosis can be hard or challenging with that for the doctors to say, but usually it's 6 months or less. If there is some acts of daily living that the individual cannot do on their own, and that's talking about feeding themselves, dressing, getting out of bed, washing themselves. So we know as part of the, as we talk about the different conditions or times within the journey of having dementia, those things, the acts of daily living do kind of dwindle down. So that's kind of sometimes to reflect on hospice if somebody might not be eligible now, but these are things to consider. And so that's something to look at. And also if there's maybe a lot of weight loss, change in weight condition, and also the in and out of the hospital or UTI, some other kind of condition that maybe allows them to be on it. So some people might be eligible, some people might not. I think it's an opportunity to get medical care to somebody at home, just like palliative care. Like I said, somebody might not be eligible for hospice, but then they might be eligible for palliative care. Our time together is just to give you some language because not everything is shared. And then most people go, oh, I didn't know about that. I mean, that's what support groups are so amazing for, is because things are shared in support groups.
Right.
You know, like, oh, I got palliative care. What's that? So it's about being inquisitive.
Yeah. And palliative care is a great service. A lot of people don't know about it.
Yeah. And it's still becoming more. And some places call it supportive care. So it's one of these tricky words, but it's pain management and chronic management and having conversations that are relevant to your health as you stand right now.
You're really taking us beautifully through some of these treatments, beginning, middle here, and we're at the end. So what are some of the end stage treatments?
Yeah. So once again, let's just kind of review. You can get all medical treatments if you want. That's important. You can discontinue or refuse medical treatment. We said you can say no. There's also hospice that is additional medical care. There's also a couple of different other options called voluntary stopping eating and drinking and medical aid in dying or death with dignity, end of life option act. I want to review that first because I know some people have questions about that. It's becoming more, there's more states across the country that are offering it. In California, it's been here for California End of Life Option Act. It's been here for 5 years. It is an opportunity for medical treatment in which if you have a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less and have capacity to make a medically informed decision for yourself, you can get medication from your doctor to bring on a peaceful death. Okay, so those, the basic elements is terminal, 18 years and older, terminal illness, prognosis 6 months or less, have capacity to make an informed healthcare decision for yourself. And then you have a doctor's prescription. You also need, this is a process, you also need two doctors to agree on your eligibility, two oral and one written request, and also self-administer.
So you have to be able to take this group of pills, this big pile of pills, and put it in your mouth.
No, it doesn't work like that. It's usually a compound of some that's put in liquid form. So over the last years, it's not, people don't have to break up 100 pills anymore. It's a compound, but you have to be able to self-administer or feed it yourself and in a liquid form. Drinking a whole bunch of fluids in a 2 ounce, we're not going to go into the protocol right now, but it's about being able to drink liquids yourself. Not preparing the medication. Somebody else can help prepare it. And it's not, it's much more diligent, and pharmacists are very helpful with that now. We're talking about being able to swallow it, put it in your feeding tube. And now places are doing enemas that you can actually rectally do it. So those are some options. What I wanted to highlight with us here today, as you probably heard, and when I do a lot of presentations around the state, is if you have dementia, that you're not eligible for this. You have to be able at a certain period of time, be able to say that this is what something I want at this moment in time. There's also a 15-day waiting period, which is actually being starting January 22, is going to be moved to 48 hours. So there's also a time constriction to do this. If you're not able to make an informed healthcare decision for yourself at a certain period of time, you're not eligible. And so that's most people with Alzheimer's.
Right. A dementia diagnosis, you would not be able to do this.
I mean, some people have capacities and interests. That's a whole different conversation, right?
Right.
Barbara, when you talk about capacity for health or for driving or for legal or financial, we always talk about capacity. And this is a whole nother, we talk about a lot of capacity when it relates to health and finances. And this is one of them. The idea is from that and from these conversations, and this can cause a lot of grief for people because a lot of people might not be eligible for it because of their eligibility. They might don't have a terminal illness. They might not be able to swallow anymore. There's some windows there. It's very challenging. So what has been discussed and is becoming just as relevant as death with dignity, or now it's called medical aid in dying because anybody's death should be dignified. So it's called medical aid in dying or the End of Life Option Act, is voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And so this goes hand in hand with those dementia priorities and tools we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. At what point is not quality of life? Because at a certain point, some people can decide for themselves if they, depending on where they are with their illness, that they can decide that they want to stop eating and or drinking. Now, when you have this option, you really need a strong medical team and advocates around you to help you with this process. It's usually a process that is about 7 to 10 days, and it's about people lack of fluids and stepping back, but you still can manage people's pains and so on. So that's another option that a lot of people consider. It's something you have to talk about in advance because to get buy-in from family and the team around you, and it's mostly happens in the home than in like a facility.
Is that a document? So is a voluntary stopping of eating and drinking, it's not a document that you fill out ahead of time. It's something you just talk about and is implemented by your family? How does that happen?
It's really, that's what these addendums are for.
Mm-hmm.
Is those, there is not a visa directive. There is none, but it's about these dementia and priority tools that in ongoing conversation, that it's just conversation or this document to kind of really touch base. And it, once again, it's a gift to the family of saying, when the only thing I'm doing is my mouth moves to eat, because that's one of the last things the brain functioning is to go, that that's not quality of life in terms of antibiotics or any one of these life-sustaining treatments.
Wow. That would be, I would imagine that would be hard for any caregiver to follow through with, unless you really know that the major organs are shutting down and food is,
And Washington nutrition. State has End of Life Washington that has an amazing model that really walks families through that. And we're seeing that more in California. There's a lot more conversations and discussion about VSED of kind of like what we follow in terms of really honoring people's wishes and knowing what quality of life is for that individual. It can be hard, just like medical aid in dying is hard, but it's also the gift of honoring those people's wishes and not seeing them suffer, because that's what a lot of this, what is suffering look like to you? And that's kind of some of the questions. And people have different beliefs about what is suffering. And it could be based on your own experience, your culture. It could be based on ethics. It can be based on religion, societal. But as an individual, you still can have that choice, but you need to have the right team around you. And it needs to be a conversation. You can't do this alone.
Yeah, a team around you that can really follow through with what you want.
Yeah. I don't know if you've had anybody in your groups that have talked about this as options, but it could be hard, but it can also be, once again, knowing that you're on that you're, this is not about you. It's about honoring that person's wishes and knowing that this is not quality of life for them. They're already dying, but this is something that at a certain point, or this is not quality of life, or they're suffering physically or existentially. This is not done in a vacuum when it comes to medical aid in dying, and also with B said, and with medical aid in dying, it is a law. It's not, I mean, you can do that's available for everybody, but you have to talk about all these end of life options.
Right.
Medical aid in dying and B said is in partnership with palliative care and hospice. It's not instead of. You really need to have these teams of support to meet you where you are. And that's really, if it's important for you to be at home, these are some of the options to consider. When I worked for the Organization of Medical Aid in Dying, it was an opportunity to have these conversations. Everybody might not agree with it or comfortable with it, but what it does is provide you with an opportunity to reflect and validate what is important to you at this given time.
I think that's the perfect place to end, because that's just what we're trying to do here, is open people's minds, open people's hearts to having these sorts of conversations with their loved ones, their spouses, their children, their family, neighbors, whoever is in their life, their support system. I'm hoping today just gives people the tools to start these conversations with whoever is on their team.
Yeah, and there's resources like Barbara and myself that are here to hold space for this. For these conversations and embrace the fear and joy of knowing, of honoring your wishes. Because once again, it's a gift. You've lived your life a certain way, and the idea of being able to die in a way that honors the way you live.
Stephanie, thank you. I really appreciate you being here today and talking so thoroughly and thoughtfully about such a hard subject. So thank you.
Greatly appreciated.
Thank you for joining us today on another episode of Dementia Discussions. If you're a caregiver or know someone who's a caregiver that would like to be a guest on the show, please call me at 310-362-8232 or go to dementiadiscussions.net/contact and let me know. It takes courage, because not everyone's willing to do that. I would love to have you. Remember that you can follow Dementia Discussions on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, it would mean a lot if you would leave a review. For any other information about this podcast, please visit me at dementiadiscussions.net. And please share this podcast with someone you know if you think it may help. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you here again next time on Dementia Discussions.